The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. Taping this on a Tuesday afternoon. It's running Wednesday, the day of the 2012 draft lottery, which has become one of the surprisingly most fun internet half hours that anyone could spend who likes basketball on the internet. On the line, the guy who has devoted his life and his next five lives to figuring out the NBA draft, ESPN's own Chad Ford. What's happening?
What's going on, Bill? Good to hear your voice.
I'm excited. Let's table the Andre Drummond argument for about 20 minutes, because I know that's going to get heated, and we might even have to ring a bell and go to our respective corners. First of all, in your opinion, which NBA team needs to win this lottery the most?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. It's the Bobcats. I mean, they're just terrible. They don't have any future stars on their team. They've completely mismanaged this team over the last 5 years. And now that they're starting over, they don't have a great foundation to rebuild from. And unfortunately, in this draft, there's a big drop-off between Anthony Davis at number one and whoever you want to put in there at number two, a big drop-off. And so you get either a franchise player like Anthony Davis at number one, or you get a nice player at number two, three, or four, or wherever the Bobcats would pick. And the difference for a franchise like Bobcats, which I don't think have anything going for them right now, is dramatic. I don't know what you do if you're Rich Cho, the general manager of the Bobcats, if you do not get the number one pick in the draft here.
I'm going to respectfully disagree.
Okay.
I think that you made some good points. I appreciate them. I think that this lottery means the most for the Brooklyn Nets. If they somehow were able to get Anthony Davis and get the number one pick, which double reverse whammy for them, because then they're not losing their pick to Portland. So you get both of those things. But think about it. How are they going to open this arena in October? Who's playing on this team? There's what, a 40-60 chance Darren Williams is going to be in this team. We know they're not going to get Dwight Howard. They have Gerald Wallace, who they inexplicably traded a top three protected number one pick for. I'm still trying to figure out why that happened. And if they got Anthony Davis, all of a sudden now they're opening this building in Brooklyn. Hey, we got Anthony Davis. That's like a real thing. If Charlotte gets Anthony Davis, they're a terrible small market team that now has a good player. That's the difference. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, I agree with you that it would be huge for the Nets. It would be a great motivator for Darren Williams to re-sign with them this summer. And he immediately... There's a few teams that if they get Anthony Davis this year, they are playoff teams next year. And I think the Nets had the worst record of those teams that could make the lead to a playoff team next year. But the other team that I think he would be huge on is the Detroit Pistons, who have a lot of talent on their team, but they just don't have anybody who can rebound and block shots. If you put Davis on the floor with Greg Monroe, you're talking about a team that immediately jumps into the playoffs, and suddenly they're one of the young, hot, up-and-coming teams. Without him, they're out there still searching for that big man who's very, very hard to find, and they're going to be a middling team that's still struggling to get out of the lottery. And so those are the teams that I think make the huge leap. It means a lot to the Bobcats, because if they don't get Davis, here's what's in store for them. The 2013 NBA draft, and I know every year we want to say, oh, the draft's not going to be good next year or whatever. It looks awful, just absolutely, totally awful next year in 2013. Hmm. And if the NBA gets their way and starts to get players an age limit moved up to where players can't go into the draft until they're after their sophomore year, now you're killing the 2014 draft. It could be potentially devastating, like kill the franchise devastatingly bad for the Charlotte Bobcats. But I agree on the upside. no team has a bigger upside than the Nets. If the Nets get Anthony Davis, they don't need to worry about Dwight Howard anymore. They have this young guy who makes a lot less money than Dwight Howard, who can do some similar things to Dwight Howard. The excitement's there. They're moving to Brooklyn. It's huge.
And you left this part out. They have a trade trip for Dwight Howard if they really want to play that card. If Darren Williams says, you know what, Anthony Davis sounds great. I think he's got a ton of potential. I could see him making small NBA teams. I love his unibrow. Seems like a nice guy. Go get me Dwight Howard, please. Use Anthony Davis to get Dwight Howard. That could be interesting, too. And if anything, I think Orlando might have to throw in something else in that trade. When you think about the salary difference and the fact that Howard's a free agent in a year, you could almost say that Anthony Davis might be worth more than Dwight Howard. Who says no to that trade straight up?
Well, I don't think either team does. It's a huge win for Orlando because the way that the rookie salaries are structured, you don't just get Anthony Davis for the next 5 years. You get him for, you know, probably a minimum of, you know, 6 to 7 years, which means the team can exhale and relax and start to rebuild the franchise right away. It's a no-brainer for Orlando. I don't know why New Jersey would do it, and that's not any disrespect to Dwight Howard, who I think is a great player, but this is a guy coming off back surgery who can be a free agent in a year. It's been incredibly difficult to deal with from his franchise, and he just makes so much more money than Anthony Davis does. If they can keep Anthony Davis, they can use all of that money that they were going to spend on Dwight Howard to bring in other terrific veteran players to put around him and be a much stronger and deeper team. If they do the Dwight Howard thing, they have to sort of gut their roster and will be doing more of the Miami Heat type of deal where you have two or three really great players and then a bunch of role players around them. They can build a much deeper team if they keep Anthony Davis. I think all around, I think you're right, Anthony Davis, in a weird way, is more valuable than Dwight Howard is right now.
You just used logic, which should be illegal if you're talking about the Nets. Everything you said makes sense. And if you and I were running the Nets or trying to figure out how to do it, we would say, we'll take Anthony Davis. Then we'll use the rest of our cap space to go get one more free agent. We'll put Anthony Davis and Brooke Lopez together. We have Gerald Wallace. We'll bring Darren Williams back. Maybe we'll go get the best restricted free agent out there and overpay the guy a little. Now we have a real starting five. I don't know if the Nets are wired that way. It seems like everything they've done for the past year or so has revolved around trying to get Darren Williams and Dwight Howard on their team. And that includes the bizarre Gerald Wallace trade. What was your reaction when you heard of that Gerald Wallace trade?
Flabbergasted. And you know, the funny thing is I wrote, I don't know, a couple of months ago that Billy King should be fired for that trade. And I got this very interesting email back from the Nets, complaining about the article and questioning how anybody could question whether this deal was good or not. It was bad at so many levels. I mean, we could go through it all now, but maybe the biggest one of all is if you talk to other teams around the trade deadline, the Blazers were looking to move Gerald Wallace for a mid to late first round pick.
Right. Yeah.
They gave away a top three protected pick. Probably will end up being the number six pick in the draft for him when they had another lottery pick.
Yes. And then you left out
that they could have given.
You left out a couple parts. One was that they said the reason they didn't mind putting a top three protection that's in on that pick was that they only like three players in the draft. That is so stupid. First of all, just because you only like three players in the draft doesn't mean that other teams might not like five, six, seven, eight players in the draft. So you might have the number seven pick, but some other team that wants to trade with you might think that that seventh pick is actually the second best guy in the draft. So to say that you have decided there are only three players worth the draft and 29 other people haven't made that decision is absolutely fundamentally inane. And then secondly, as you said, The price for Gerald Wallace was what it was. They just wanted to dump his contract. And I actually think he has a player option for this summer anyway.
He's going to opt out. And,
yeah.
And my guess is they're going to re-sign him probably what I've been hearing, the rumblings are 3 years, $24
million. Ooh, congratulations on that for
both
parties.
So you also get to pay a lot of money to a guy. He could turn around and screw him and leave, and they'd be stuck with nothing. I mean, that's, he's an unrestricted free agent. He can do what he wants. If I was another NBA general manager, I'd at least mess with the Nets a little bit and start talking about a bigger contract than that, if nothing else, just to get him to overpay so they have less cap room.
Yeah, to panic, yeah. It's a competitive move. I agree with you. They should do that. The other funny thing is, all right, if you're trading that pick just on the premise of we want to get a player that will help us get Dwight Howard and keep Darren Williams, and Paul Pierce was on the table, Paul Pierce would have given them a better chance at getting Dwight Howard and keeping Darren Williams than Gerald Wallace, who was the third best player on a sub-500 team. And it was had, I think, one season in his entire career that I think we could say was like an all-star caliber season. At least with the way science is going and the way these guys are playing into their late 30s, I'm pretty sure that Paul Pierce is going to have a better next 2-3 years than Gerald Wallace is. And they're making that move for the present anyway. I'm just dumbfounded by the whole thing. At least put like a top 10 protection on it. Does Portland say no to top 10 protection? Not in a million years.
Well, they're going to say, well, that they told us that's the only way they would do the deal. But that's why you get someone who's a savvy negotiator to make this deal. You know, the other thing about Wallace, I think you're probably right about Pierce. Is the difference is, even though Pierce is older, he has more to his game than athleticism. Wallace's game relies tremendously on his elite athletic ability, and that is waning,
right,
as it does at players his age. And he doesn't have other things to fall back on that can allow him to stay in the league for more years. And the guys that are staying into their mid-30s are staying because they have other skills that make up for their declining athletic ability.
It's a great point. He's a glorified energy guy. And we've seen those guys, their careers peter out in their early 30s usually, unless they figure out a different component to their game. I feel like Dwight Howard, Paul Pierce, and Darren Williams, it's a pretty nice threesome. You go into a playoff series with those two guys and you hit the role players correctly, and you're in pretty good shape. Now, this all could work out for the Nets. They might fall ass backwards in a top three pick here. I do feel like, though, if they somehow got Davis, I don't know why we're wasting so much time talking about it, it's my fault, but if they somehow got Davis, I could see them trading Davis for Dwight Howard. I know it's insane, but I really could. I really feel like they're focused on that Dwight Howard, Darren Williams thing. I think that's been their intention for the last year. And if you told them a year ago, look, everything is going to work out in a way that you're going to have Dwight Howard and Darren Williams, I don't think they'd care what they gave up. I really don't.
Oh, and I think they would use the exact same logic that they used to trade the pick to Portland for Gerald Wallace. Hmm. They want to win now. They want established players. They want veterans. They want to compete for a championship right away. And that Anthony Davis is 19 years old.
Yeah.
He's young. He's unproven. He has a lot to grow, which I actually agree. He does have a huge space to kind of grow up in the NBA. And I think he will struggle a little bit as a rookie, if nothing else, with just the physicality of the league. He's going to be good. But as a rookie, maybe he won't quite be there, and they'll be short-sighted, and they'll try to win it now. And I think the problem is Darren Williams, Dwight Howard, Gerald Wallace, very good team. Not sure it's a championship-caliber team.
All right, how about most fun team Anthony Davis could go to? And I'm only accepting teams that are one of the eight teams with the best odds, because after that it would be kind of crazy for
somebody.
So we
can't say Steve Nash stays at Phoenix.
Yeah, we can't say Phoenix.
And Alvin Gentry plays the up and down style again, and we see Nash throwing lobs to Anthony or to
yeah, we
Anthony
can't say
Davis
that
all year.
Yeah, because that's the most fun scenario, but that's very unlikely. About as unlikely as Billy King making another good trade. What do you think is the most fun, realistic situation for him?
Well, I think Washington has some pieces.
Bingo.
I
agree with you. Bingo.
And I think John Wall to Anthony Davis, you've got something there.
And not just that. What about I battle on Nene. I think he's a legitimate center. I think he's overpaid. The situation is what it is. They have him. He's on their team. You put Anthony Davis and Nene together, pretty interesting combo. I mean, not a lot of teams in the NBA in 2013 are going to be big up front, you know? Everybody usually has one guy. Nobody other than three or four teams has two guys who can protect the rim and play above the rim and do that. And, you know, and then throw in John Wall, who this is a total tangent here. John Wall, disappointed after 2 years? I'm disappointed.
I'm disappointed too, but when you look at the context, when you look at who's been around him, when you look at how dysfunctional this team's been for the last couple of years, I don't totally put it on his shoulders.
Okay.
Maybe, you know, if he was Derrick Rose, I think Derrick Rose would have transcended some of that and maybe changed the culture there.
Yeah.
And maybe John Wall's not quite that good to be able to do that. But I think with the right coach, with the right players around him, I do agree with Washington and how they've been getting rid of many of the players they've got. Of course, you know, they pat themselves on the back and forget they're the ones who brought those players in. It's not a regime change somehow.
Right.
Their team is in the right direction. I'll give you another sleeper, though, just because it would be fun to see the drama if Anthony Davis goes to Cleveland.
Oh.
With Kyrie Irving.
That's my number two choice. I think Washington – actually, you know what? Cleveland might be my number one choice because if – what did we think of Tristan Thompson in year one? I kind of enjoyed him as an energy guy. I don't know if he should have gone fourth in the draft, but it's not like he's bad. He's
solid.
He could be the fourth best guy on a really good team, right?
Right.
Right. So Irving and Davis, if they're your 1-2, Varejao could definitely be the third best guy on a really good team. And then Thompson, there's some pieces there. That might be a playoff team. I was stunned by how good Kyrie Irving was. I can't remember. Where did you stand on him heading into the draft last year?
Oh, I thought he was the number one pick for sure. But I'm pretty sure, you know, obviously I want to think now that I liked him maybe a little more than I did. I thought he was going to be a really good pro. I questioned, given the guard talent in the East, whether he would be an all-star.
Yeah, I agreed with you.
Some of the other point guards that are in the East ahead of me.
I agreed with you. My whole take was I thought Derek Williams should have gone ahead of him because I didn't think if you took Kyrie Irving, you're taking guy number one who never had a chance to make an all-star team. Then you watch the guy for 3 weeks and you go, ooh, wow, that was a mistake. This guy's going to make a few all-star teams.
He might make an all-star team. Now, yeah. He's going to have to get past Deron Williams and Derrick Rose and Rajon Rondo to do it. And I wondered whether he could even get, you know, John Wall, I thought, because of his elite athletic ability, might be ahead of the curve there. I don't believe that anymore. I think Kyrie Irving's already better than John Wall right now.
Well, and then the thing that really, forget all-star teams and all that stuff, the thing that made him special was the way that he played at the end of games.
Right.
And it's one of those rare times where you go look at the 82games.com crunch time stats expecting a certain result, and then you see it and you go, wow, that's even better than I thought it was going to be. And his field goal percentage in tight games was just supernaturally high. I think he was shot like 57% or something, which was especially amazing considering he was the only guy on the team who could do anything at the end of games. He really seems like he's going to be special. So yeah, you know, I got an email a couple weeks ago from somebody saying that how ironic is it that Cleveland has a 13.8% chance or whatever it is of winning a title before LeBron. And you think about that, it's like, haha, well, Miami will win. It's like, I don't know, man. I'm watching these finals. And again, we're taping this Tuesday before game two, but I think San Antonio, unless somebody gets injured, is going to cruise to this title. And I don't mean that as a jinx. I just think they have the best team. I don't think it's close. And if Miami doesn't win this year and then Cleveland gets Anthony Davis, that would be interesting. I don't know who wins a title first at that point.
The clock starts ticking.
Yeah.
It's not like Cleveland will win the title next year.
No.
When they get Anthony Davis. But they've got the pieces now to build a really fantastic team, and the pressure's on Miami. Now, do you make changes?
Right.
Do they do this? There's a lot of questions that start to happen in Miami, and I think it's a legitimate question to start to ask.
And not
but
a lot
I
of...
think it would be great karma for Cavs fans.
Oh, they'd be so happy. That's why it would be fun if they got it. But yeah, Miami doesn't have a ton of salary cap flexibility either. I mean, I'm sure they'll get one more Shane Battier-type guy, but... other than that, unless they were willing to move Bosch, I don't feel like they'd have a way to really dramatically change the roster. And the other thing is, we saw it last night, LeBron played 44 minutes. I thought Spoelstra wore him down last year in the finals. I wrote about this a little for our sports blog today. Played 450 minutes in 10 playoff games at one point, heading from round two all the way through game one of the finals last year. And I thought he wore down. This year he's playing... you know, he's in that 42 to 43 minute range and he plays so hard that I do wonder. I wonder how this guy's going to age, because he's the way that the intensity that he plays and the amount of minutes that he logs and the number of hits he takes and how many games he's played over these first 9 years. You know, at some point, what is he going to just keep doing this for another 10? Like, at some point, he's going to start to wear down, don't you think?
Might be. I think he's a cyborg, though. So I'm not really sure LeBron James is going to wear down.
Oh, that would be interesting if he was a cyborg. I feel like that would be one of the 10 biggest scandals. All right. I wouldn't be stunned either, because it is amazing. The guy's indestructible. Like, he crashes into camera guys, and other guys would be down for 10 minutes, and he hops up. It's like, oh, yeah, that camera hit me in the leg. That hurt. And he laughs and just runs back. Pretty incredibly durable through these 9 years. So, second pick, because once somebody gets the first pick, everybody knows Davis is going first. And now the backup narrative will be who goes second. Has that played itself out yet, or you feel like there's a few guys who have their hats in the ring there?
I think there's a few that have their hats in the ring, but can I first make a plea to the NBA?
Yeah.
Can we not pretend like the number one pick is up for grabs? I know as part of their narrative and their storytelling, they actually prohibit general managers from announcing who they're going to take with the number one pick. Can we not pretend that that whoever wins this doesn't know who they're going to take? And doesn't have to go through the farce of we're going to bring in multiple guys and we're going to do the interviews and, you know, all of these things. Can we just have a giant cutout of Anthony Davis wearing the jersey of whoever gets the number one pick in the draft? I mean, it's such a no-brainer. And we're going to go through this ridiculous period of a month where a team pretends that they don't know who they're going to take. And the only reason they're pretending is because the league is forcing them to. And in this particular situation, it's completely nuts. There's no way, no matter who gets the number one pick in the draft, that it's not going to be Anthony Davis. I just begging the league that we don't have to go through this farce for the next month.
I'll go one step further. I think they should make him one of the co-hosts of the lottery show. And I think he should hug the winning GM or representative or whatever. I think he should put on the jersey. Like, let's just have fun with it. He's going to be on the team anyway. Invite him. Put him in Secaucus, wherever they do it. They're doing it in Secaucus again, right? In that little...
No, it's actually in Times Square.
Oh. Is that new?
This is new. First year. This is why you keep hearing the sirens behind me, because apparently in Times Square, there's a siren that goes off every 3 to 4 minutes here. I'm not sure. Is there just rampant crime? Are there fires just busting out everywhere? All day and night.
It might make it easier to fix the lottery. If the goal is really to get him to Brooklyn, you might want to have the lottery in a place where sirens go off every 3 to 4 minutes.
Yeah,
could make it a little bit easier. One of the funniest subplots of this lottery is that there's multiple teams here that people will be screaming conspiracy if they win the lottery, right?
Oh, for sure.
Cleveland, conspiracy. Brooklyn, conspiracy. New Orleans, who is still owned by the league through July.
Conspiracy.
Would be the ultimate conspiracy. Hey, Tom Benson, we know we've been trying to get you to buy the Hornets for a year, and then inexplicably after the Bounty Gate thing happened, you decided you wanted to buy the Hornets. Here's the number one pick.
Yeah,
we'll get this.
Sacramento word. Conspiracy.
Oh, I didn't even think of them.
Now this will be the impetus to get the arena that the Maloofs need.
Oh, so let's rank the conspiracies. I still say Brooklyn's one. If Davis goes to Brooklyn, that's just great for them. With this, the Brooklyn franchise means more to the league, I feel like, than Sacramento, Charlotte, some of these other small market teams. This is potentially.
But you're discounting the whole Prokhorov bot, the security firm.
Oh.
That authorizes the results, or that guarantees that the results were accurate to the lottery.
I would normally be 100% in on that theory, but I don't even think Prokhorov knows he owns the Nets anymore. When was the last time anyone seen Prokhorov?
It is interesting.
Where has he been?
Of course, the way they've played the last couple of years, you sort of understand.
Prokhorov should have Billy King's car should have blown up after he made that Jared Wallace trade. That should have been it. We never should have seen him again. Prokhorov needs to get more invested in this team, and he needs to find these security, who's in charge of the lottery?
I don't know. There's always some sort of accounting firm that, you know, brings it out, and they stand there and nod. And there's also the director of security for the NBA.
That would be funny if they introduced the guy this year and his name was like Igor.
Yeah.
And he had like a heavy, heavy Russian accent. But like, oh. Brooklyn, I think, is the number one conspiracy thing. And New Orleans is a close number two. And then after that, yeah, Sacramento. And then, Cleveland getting screwed over by the decision and then winning back-to-back number one overall picks would be pretty fishy. You're just looking at that, I'm like, wow.
Totally. Portland, payback for sending Greg Oden, the broken big man. Now we're going to send you a real one.
Yeah, I hesitate to say this, and I really like the fans in Portland, and this will probably be put in a transcript on Blazers Edge, and then all these people write me in comments about me underneath it, but I'm just going to say it. Portland's had such bad history with the number one overall pick and centers that would worry me if Anthony Davis went there, right? If you're Anthony Davis, you're scared. It's almost like you're buying the Amityville Horror House. You're concerned. It's like, oh, Portland, you guys aren't trading the pick, are you? I don't know. That would make me nervous. I'd like to see Portland get the overall pick in a year, number one overall in a year when it's not a consensus shot blocking big man.
Aren't you similarly concerned if Charlotte gets it and Michael Jordan flexes you as the number one pick?
You talk to a lot of people. What do the people you talk to say about the job that he did running that team? I mean, are people just perplexed? Because the people I talk to almost don't understand it because he's such like a crazy, homicidally competitive guy, and yet he just presided over the most losingest, most inept team in history, whatever adjective fits, they were the worst at it. And now he's like, I just think the dichotomy of those two things is crazy. And that seems to be the consensus people I talk to. What do people
Well, especially when you have a guy like Larry Bird, on the other hand, who's been successful at it.
Mm.
And so it's not just, ex-players don't know how to be GM. There's been some ex-players that have been terrific GM. Jerry West has been. Larry Bird has been. Joe Dumars has won an NBA title as an ex-player, built a team that was super competitive. During the last decade, I mean, you can do it. I think it's this, and I don't know if you saw the TNT guys opening the show for the Western Conference Finals, talking about Shaq being the GM, and you had Charles Barkley and everyone talking and laughing about it. And Charles Barkley talking about all the idiot GMs that are in the league, and he's, I don't know the idiot's the right word, but there's some not very good GMs in the league, and Shaq says something to the effect, and I'm going to mangle it, that, look, I know what to do, right? You hire great people around you, and they do all the work, and then I leave, right? Which basically translates to, I'm on the golf course.
Yep.
People will give me all the information, and I'll be the decider, right? And I think that there's a perception for some GMs that that's what the job is. Right, or in this case, owners, or whatever. I'm the decider, and everybody else sort of does the work and gives me the information, and I decide. And that, but then you have to know who are the guys that I'm hiring. Are they the right guys? Are they giving me the right information? Are they telling me what I want to hear? Or are they actually giving me their real opinions? I mean, there's so many questions that go into that. It was a pretty funny. I thought it was funny for Shaq to sort of say that as that's my pitch, right? If you hire me and pay me millions of dollars, I will bring in people who actually know what they're doing with the job. They'll give me all the information, and then I'll choose.
Right. Well, what he's describing is basically then they should make him the president of the team or something. The GM is somebody who actually puts real thought into how to compose a roster.
Right. Now, Jordan's an owner, not a GM.
Well, yeah.
But we all expect him to be more engaged because of who he is and what he's done. I mean, we don't expect this out of every owner. In fact, sometimes we yell at owners like Paul Allen and say, stay out of it, right? Why are you so hands-on? And so there's a little bit of a double standard there, but I think it is because of Jordan and who he is and what he's meant to the league that we expect Jordan to have somehow the sixth sense about how to do all this stuff, and I just don't think he does.
Yeah, wow. I know he does because we've watched him run that team for the last few years. He seems like he's pretty bad at it. And he was not great with the Wizards either when he was running that team. I do feel like just because you were a great player does not necessarily translate into being good at that job. I think there's some pieces that go along with it. But, if you look at how Bird has succeeded with Indiana the last few years, part of that was because he had good people around him. But he'd seem like he put sincere thought into the right kind of team to build and the right kind of personalities to have and chemistry and things like that. And that's something that, like, for instance, Isaiah Thomas just totally failed at because he discounted chemistry completely. And, you know, I think that's what happens sometimes with, and I think McHale is another good example of this, and Jordan, obviously, of people that they just didn't think about chemistry because they were on teams that were just really talented and won. And their attitude was always, that's fine. Steven Jackson will be fine. You know, like they just, I played with guys like Steven Jackson. I played with guys like Sprewell. And they don't really think about it past that. Whereas the Spurs are a team that, you know, has looked so carefully at that. And even when they acquired Steven Jackson, put some real thought into it and realized that maybe he's not for everybody. But for that team, it made a lot of sense. And they needed kind of the crazy guy who was the irrational confidence guy who could, you could stare at him in the timeout and go, hey, could you shut down Kevin Durant? And he could say, yeah, I'm going to shut him down. I'll do that for you. And then actually do it. And they needed somebody like that. And anyway, back to Jordan. I don't know if he thinks about a roster that way. I don't know what he thinks, to be honest, but
I don't know either. And I find this interesting about the Spurs because they're an amazing organization. It's every job opening that comes, who's the guy that go gets coffee for R.C. Buford? Let's consider him for the GM. I mean, there's a
right.
There's this whole thing. If you work for the Spurs now, there's some sort of magical gift that you have. And look, they've done an amazing, amazing job, better than any franchise in the NBA. And they have a lot of pieces that have come together to make that happen. One is they've had a consistent coach, Greg Popovich, who's an incredible coach through all of this. That makes a big, big difference for a franchise because one of the things, they can trade for Steven Jackson because they know Greg Popovich can handle Steven Jackson, right?
And wanted to coach him. And he wanted
to
coach him.
Coach him.
Yeah, he asked to coach him, didn't he? Yeah. Wasn't he the one who pushed for it?
Yeah, he knows how to coach him. He can handle him. He knows how to do it. Second, they're incredibly smart. R.C. Buford is a genius, and they put in and they outwork just about everyone. They go to every little thing that I'm at, there's someone from the Spurs there. There's other teams aren't there. There's someone from the Spurs there. They are they have a voracious appetite for gathering information, and no small piece of information is too small for them so that they can make the right decision. I think that's a huge plus for the Spurs,
yeah.
And other teams just get outworked by them, and that's a big thing. But then there's the other thing that no one's factoring into this, and that they got two number one picks. And the second one with Tim Duncan in, you know, one of the best drafts ever, they get the number one pick. And it just happens to be a year that they're a playoff team the year before. David Robinson gets injured for the year, and they get the number one pick in the draft. And some of that is luck.
Right.
And I'm not sure we would talk, even with the Spurs having a brilliant coach like Greg Popovich, and even with a great staff who's smarter than most teams and outworks most teams, I'm not sure we feel the same way about the Spurs if they don't get Tim Duncan.
Well,
in the draft.
And on top of that, I think he's somebody, it's a little bit easier if you're Popovich to coach a team when you also have Duncan on that team. And he's the anchor and he's the guy, the personality manager, basically. You swinging this back to the lottery. I realized this the other day. Duncan is the greatest lottery pick, the greatest number one overall lottery pick of all time. If you go back to 1984, yeah, seems to be a belief that Ewing was the best lottery pick ever but actually, if you just look at the breadth of somebody's career, you'd have to rank Duncan first. I think Hakeem is second. And then Shaq's third. I have Hakeem ahead of Shaq on the all-time list. I think I did anyway.
Spurs improved by 36 games. The year, an NBA record, the next best was 20, and that's when the Magic got Shaq. They improved by 36 games. They go from a 20-win team to a 56-win team in 1997. Now, with that said, they also got a healthy David Robinson back.
They
were a playoff team before that.
Wait, some would say he was healthy the second half of the year that they tanked to get David Robinson.
Yeah.
They drafted Tim Duncan, and they have gotten 15 years and counting of 60-win teams. They won four titles. They arguably could have – you could say they should have won two instead of four. You could say they should have won seven instead of four. But they were in the mix for at least half the time for the title, like, you know, serious contenders. And now I think, you know, I'd be shocked if they didn't win this year. Wouldn't you be shocked? Would you be shocked? I feel like Miami versus a San Antonio team is no contest.
Yeah, except they're older and they could run out of gas. You know, that's the only thing that I see, an injury or running out of gas is the only thing that I see coming in the way of the Spurs in a title. If they're healthy, they're going to beat anybody. But they're an older team, and especially with older teams, you run that risk.
We should mention that we're taping this on a Tuesday, and there's a chance Tim Duncan and Tony Parker collided during tonight's game and got wheeled off Vinny Johnson, Adrian Dantley style. So I hope we didn't just put the kibosh on them. But, yeah, I would say Duncan was the best-case scenario for the number one pick. Odin's obviously the at least since 1984, probably the worst-case scenario. As we've discussed on this podcast, 90% of the GMs would have taken Odin that year. You can't blame Portland for that.
I'm not sure if it was not 100%, but, you know, 90, that's fair enough. There may have been a GM or two out there that would have taken Durant.
Danny swears on the lives of his 45 kids that he would have taken Durant.
Danny Ainge?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't, you know,
we'll never know.
We'll never know. But, man, that would have been a ballsy move. Can you imagine? Think about if Danny Ainge takes Durant and then Odin has all the health problems that he ended up having and the ramifications that just, you know, then Danny is hailed as the all-time genius ever who laughed in the face of everyone who thought he should take an Odin and look how it worked out. Now he's being mentioned as one of the all-time, you know, and then the Celtics are winning, you know, at least competing for titles with Durant. Some would say they're competing for the title this year, but I think they're so banged up, it's not that realistic.
Well, and look, there's this mystique, and maybe this is our way to segue into our Andre Drummond argument that I know that you want to have.
Yes.
There's this mystique around big guys in the NBA where people just get irrational about it. When you see someone who's 6'11 or bigger, especially if they've got some meat on their bones, and let's say they're 250, 260 or higher, and they can walk in a straight line and chew gum at the same time. There is this mystique around these guys and this belief, this deep-seated belief in virtually every GM in the league, that if I can get a dominant big man, I am going to have a team that competes for a championship year after year after year. And they don't feel the same way about power forwards and shooting guards and even point guards. They just don't feel the same way about it. And so when one of those guys comes along and they pass the sort of smell test, there is such a cultural pull in the NBA to take that guy so he could be the next Shaq or the next Tim Duncan or the next Hakeem that all sort of rational thought goes out the window with these guys. And you understand why I don't want to be the guy who passed on Tim Duncan, or I don't want to be the guy who passed on Hakeem or Shaq or.
Well,
or
nobody whoever. Passed on those guys, though. Like, who's a better example of somebody that came back to haunt? I guess, like, Greg Monroe is a decent example, right? I mean, you'd think Drummond's upside on paper is better than Greg Monroe, but Greg Monroe is somebody that fell about 3-4 picks further than he should have. I think Cousins is another example. I think Minnesota taking Wes Johnson over Cousins, it's pretty tough in retrospect. If I'm a Minnesota fan, I'm not happy about that.
You know, you go back and you look at the number one picks, and when it's been a clear case that they're the number one pick, like Yao was, like Hakeem was, you know, where it's clear, where Shaq was, for example, teams are usually right. And the big guys that went high in draft that were not good, Oluwakandi, for example, or Kwame Brown, there was huge debate. There was no clear-cut number one pick in the draft those years. And there was huge debate sort of around who should be that guy.
Eddie Curry is another one.
Yeah, Eddie Curry, another great example.
Hashim Thabeet, who both of us
hated.
We smelled that one out, yeah.
Yeah. We've learned our lesson.
Yeah,
which gets us to Andre Drummond, because I just saw him work out in New York today. He is huge, absolutely huge. Has the body of a 26-year-old man. Can jump out of the gym, moves laterally like a guard, explosive athletically. Looks a little bit like Amari Stoudemire, but bigger. A bigger version of Amari Stoudemire. And you watch this guy work out, and I only actually got to see a small amount of a workout. He had food poisoning over the weekend and was just sort of back in the gym and still wasn't really feeling 100%. But it doesn't take long to see, from a physical standpoint, who he really reminded me more of than anybody that I've seen since I've been doing the draft was a young Dwight Howard. I mean, he looks the part of a young Dwight Howard. And you walk out in a daze afterwards and say, "How?" If you're a GM and you see this and all these things this guy in the workout, you understand why teams struggle to pass on guys like that. Because if he's any good at all, there's no one who can match up with him size-wise and athletically-wise in the NBA. He's going to be dominant the same way Dwight Howard's dominant now, in part because there's no other big men to stop Dwight Howard. If Dwight Howard was playing in the age of Akeem and Patrick Ewing, and you know David Robinson, all those guys, I don't think he would be as great as he is, because he's not really that skilled. But because there's no one to stop Dwight Howard on a night-to-night basis, he gets to do whatever he wants. Right. Look at Andre Drummond; you could say the exact same thing about him. If he gets it, and if he plays hard, he can do whatever he wants out there.
It's a very compelling case. Here are my red flags in order. Number one, didn't try hard all the time in college.
And high school.
I think we've learned over the years that that's a red flag, because if you're not trying hard during the year that you're trying to convince people to pay you as much money as possible coming out of college, the odds are that you're still not going to try hard once you're getting paid what you know you're going to be making every year.
Yeah.
So that part worries me. We've just been burned too many times with that. You know, you left out somebody that was a polarizing quote-unquote big man, Amari Stoudemire, who... Yeah.
Didn't try hard all the time.
Also
had fairly pathetic high school numbers.
And also had the really weird family situation that scared teams off.
Five high school teams in 4 years.
Right. Had a mom, no offense to Amari, but a mom that had a pretty big reputation as being difficult. And on top of that, we were in the middle of an era when people had been taking young guys too high and been getting burned. And he ended up falling, I think, to the 8th or 9th pick. But wasn't he another guy who was like a huge workout guy? Like once people worked him out, they're like, oh, my God.
Phoenix worked him out and shut him down. And he ended up going like number 9. But part of the reason he went number 9 is he really didn't work out for any other teams. Phoenix saw him, fell in love with him, shut him down in the workout. And he really never went to other teams, which is one of the reasons that he slid where he did in the draft.
So he wanted to go to Phoenix then?
I guess so.
That's interesting. So you feel like Drummond, people will work him out and be so wowed by his physical traits. And I call this the Yi Jin Lan, the chair theory, where you
dominates
see
the chair, yeah.
Dominates the chair. And they're going to be so wowed by this that they're going to overlook the fact that he averaged 10 points and 7.6 rebounds a game in the Big East and didn't really try all the time and admitted that he didn't try hard all the time.
Yeah. I'm not saying they will, but I think a team in the top 5 will. And whether it's the number 2 pick or 3rd or 4th or 5th, one of those teams does it. And I'll tell you why. Everything you said is right. And they're huge red flags. Let me tell you two other players that had those exact same red flags. Dwight Howard. Young kid coming out of high school. I watched him work out in Tim Grover's gym before the pre-draft camp. He couldn't even finish the workout. He had not really been working out hard. He was goofing around, wanted to do trick shots and other things, wanted to show me that he could be a three-point shooter and do some stuff like that. Was complaining at times. I walked out of that, and you could definitely, by the way, see the athletic ability and you know all of that stuff. You walked out, I'm like, this guy's going to be the number one pick in the draft.
Yeah.
When Emeka Okafor is out there playing like a warrior for UConn, this is the guy who's going to be the number one pick in the draft. They said he's a too nice of a kid. He was a devout Christian kid. He didn't have a killer instinct. He was going to be sort of too soft and too nice. You know, people said about him. And there was a lot of debate.
Oh, I remember.
He should be the number one pick in the draft.
I remember some idiot on ESPN.com was pushing hard for Okafor. Oh, wait, it was me. Yeah.
And so there's one. And the other one was a lot of people said the same thing about Tyson Chandler when he came out. And, in fact, Michael Jordan was worried that Tyson Chandler was too soft. They had that famous, infamous day before the draft or day of the draft one-on-one between Kwame Brown and Tyson Chandler where, as unbelievable as it is to believe now, Kwame Brown apparently destroyed Tyson Chandler.
I remember hearing that story. You know what's weird, though? I remember seeing Tyson Chandler in person a couple times his rookie year, second year, when he played the Celtics, and really being impressed by how tough he was. So something must have, maybe that workout was a transformative moment for him or something.
But that was the thing in high school, was they didn't always play hard. They was afraid to get hurt, so he was afraid to sort of get, you know, he was afraid to sort of get in the scrum of things. He had no offensive game at all. And if you remember those, especially those first few years with the Bulls, it was like hot potato. He would touch the ball and then immediately kick it back out. I mean, there was all of those things about those players. So look, young players can change. And in fact, I remember going to Orlando's training camp and walking in, and Dwight Howard looked like a different person. He had worked his butt off over the summer. He had been lifting weights. He looked like a different person just in that amount of time. And, you know, he grew up a little bit. Tyson Chandler, obviously now Defensive Player of the Year, has grown up. Guys can mature.
Yeah.
And sometimes they don't.
That's all fine. If Kid Gilchrist is on the board at number two, I'm taking him. I know what I'm getting with Kid Gilchrist.
I'd take him too. He's number two on our board and for the same reason. But Kid Gilchrist doesn't have anything like the upside. You actually take Kid Gilchrist for the opposite reasons that you take Andre Drummond.
Yeah.
You take him because he's a winner, because he's an incredibly hard worker, because he's tough as nails, because he plays at 100 miles an hour every play, that you'll know consistently every single night what you're going to get from Michael Kid Gilchrist.
I'm going to go further, though. Wait, hold on, though. I think he's so competitive that whatever flaws that he might have heading into the league – He'll kill himself to fix.
Okay.
I just think his upside is the fact that certain guys are just wired that way that he's wired, and all of those guys have done well in the NBA. If all you care about is winning at basketball, and everywhere you've gone, you've won, at some point that has to mean something. And I would take him second. I don't know enough about Bradley Beal. I thought it was interesting that you said Ray Allen meets Eric Gordon. That seems a little strong. He's really going to be Ray Allen meets Eric Gordon? Bradley Beal?
He has an Eric Gordon body. You know,
okay.
Where he's built really strong and compact and probably about the same size as Eric Gordon. And in high school, he was known as the best shooter in his class. Unlimited range. Could launch it from anywhere. He struggled a little bit at Florida this year. I think he ended up shooting like 34%. From three, which isn't great.
Yeah.
And it was a screwed up system. He was often playing small forward for Florida this year, and had three guards that they would play together. And, you know, there's certain things that were odd for Beal, and he did different things. He was an incredible rebounder for a guy his size and did sort of other things in between. But if you watch his stroke, it's beautiful. It looks like a beautiful stroke. And if he's the kid that we've always thought he's going to be, and this was a blip, then you're talking about one of the few guys at his size who's a great athlete, can put the ball on the floor and can shoot. That was the comparison. He didn't shoot it, admittedly, like Ray Allen this year. And that's the one, I think, red flag for Beal right now is.
But he's got
is there a problem?
He's got the beautiful jumper. And you left out one part, like if you were thinking about Beal. Not a lot of good shooting guards right now. It's a position that is heavy with guys who are really solid or pretty good, maybe in that Aaron Aflalo range. Not you know, you look at Kobe and Wade as your top two, but if you're just looking at all-star two guards, like that's why Eric Gordon, I think, had so much value, because you just look at the under 32 guards, not a lot of them. And if that guy can be as good as Eric Gordon, then that's probably – he should be in that 3-4 range, right?
And that's by the way, I think the strength of this draft, because you've got Brad Beal, And then you've got about four other guys that I would put in the mid to late lottery. Deion Waiters out of Syracuse, Jeremy Lamb out of UConn, Terrence Ross out of Washington, and Austin Rivers out of Duke, who's probably the most polarizing of those four.
I like
all of those guys could be starting two guards in the league, and some of them could be special. And I think that's the actual strength of this draft, is at that two position. After Anthony Davis, I think we'll probably end up with around five starting shooting guards coming out of this draft.
Good. It's about time. I'm tired of watching crappy two guards. We need some more talented ones. And I also like Austin Rivers, and I know he's going to go.
You like him?
I do. I think eventually he's going to be a guy who can shoot threes and get into the paint, which are the two things I'm looking for from my shooting guard. I don't know if he's a shooting guard, but I think he can play the two. Maybe it's not ideal, but I think he can do it. I don't think he's much different than what Jason Terry did for Dallas in 2011 as an upside. Be somebody that plays the two, maybe not the traditional ideal two, but somebody that is really tough to stop, streaky. I like him. That's the interesting thing about this draft, is you might be able to get somebody like that with the 16th pick, you know? And that's what separates this draft from the other drafts, is I don't know if it's as good as people maybe thought it was a couple months ago, but I do think your chance of hitting the jackpot later in the draft seemed to be much higher this year. Would you agree?
I think so. It's a strong draft. Even when you get into the late teens and 20s, I mean, there's a guy like Tony Roten who... When you talk about Tony Roten, it sounds a lot like you're talking about Rajon Rondo.
Mm.
Pre the draft. You know, credible athlete, long, defensive nightmare, you know, gets to the paint, special passer, can't shoot. I mean, not can't shoot. Shot is broken, can't shoot.
Uh-oh.
And questions about whether, you know, he can be a leader, whether he's got the personality and the demeanor to be a point guard at the NBA, but a lot of other things that you tick off on the kid could be special too. And if he models his game after Rondo, he could be great. If he tries to be something else, he could be a flop. You know, Rivers to me is the most interesting, because here's my theory about Rivers and why he scares me. I think he grew up, unlike most of the players in this draft, he grew up
rich
around
kid.
NBA game.
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised, Bill, how many of these players, when I talk to them, don't really watch the NBA. It's just not a big thing for them. They don't watch a lot of NBA games. But we know Austin Rivers, because of his dad, has grown up around the game his whole life. And I think if you watch him play, it's clear who he's modeled his game after. He's modeled it after Kobe. There's a lot of Kobe-esque sort of moves and things that he does out there. And in high school, he could do it against anybody.
Yep.
Right? And he was so sophisticated, and his basketball IQ so high, and his moves so sophisticated, he could do it against anybody and score at will. Then he gets to college, and the defenses are tougher, guys are more athletic, they're bigger, and he struggles a little bit to do that. He struggles to be Kobe now. But... You know, as the season goes on, he figures it out, and I think he gets better as the season goes on. He could have used another year of college, in my opinion, to learn how to play off the ball more and without the ball without his hands, but whatever. Now he gets the NBA. Guys are suddenly a lot bigger, a lot faster, a lot more athletic. And here's the thing. You can have all of Kobe Bryant's moves and memorize them and be able to execute them on the floor, but if you don't have Kobe's size, and if you don't have Kobe's elite leaping and athletic ability, you're not Kobe. And you can't get away with all the things that Kobe can do. And even Kobe's starting to learn now that Kobe can't get away with all the things that Kobe used to do now, because he's not quite as athletic as he was. And so even if you say, look, his vertical is 4 inches lower than Kobe, and he's 2 inches shorter, and his wings, 3 inches shorter, in the NBA, it's a game of inches. And all of that stuff matters. And can he get it into his head that he's not Kobe and become who he is and be comfortable being who he is? Or is he a kid who's always going to be out there trying, believing and trying to emulate somebody who's not? We could say that about a lot of these prospects,
right,
in the NBA draft. Part of their success in the NBA is recognizing who they are and what they do at the NBA level that's special, and what they don't do and quit doing the things that they don't do well and emphasize the things that are special, and then they can make it in the league. And guys that go out and still believe that they're the next Michael Jordan or the next Kobe Bryant and keep wanting to play that way and take shots that way struggle.
Yeah, he should be modeling his game after Jason Terry. You know, the thing that interested me about him, and I think we just saw this happen with Avery Bradley, who really blossomed this year before he hurt his shoulder, and I think I love Avery Bradley. He's one of my favorite Celtics in a while, and I just feel like maybe he was miscast as the backup point guard. He's really just a guard, and he's a scorer, and he's somebody who can shoot, and he's an incredible defender. And I didn't really know that much about him from high school. What I didn't know is that him and John Wall were like basically neck and neck in high school. And he went to Texas, which we've seen people go to Texas and, you know, their career goes in weird ways. And he fell to 19 and then was behind Rondo playing kind of out of position because he's not really a point guard. And now he's blossoming into something that I feel like he's a legitimate guy for them. It makes me wonder, like, Austin Rivers, it's far-fetched for me to think that you could go from being the best high school guy or one of the best. He was in the top two or three, right?
Right.
To now you're saying, he wasn't as good as we thought he was going to be at Duke. Man, he's the 20th best guy in this draft. Seems like too big of a drop-off, which is why maybe the truth's in the middle somewhere. Last guy I wanted to ask you about, and then we got to go, actually. Thomas Robinson's good. Why wouldn't I be happy with the fourth pick taking Thomas Robinson?
You probably should be. I love Thomas Robinson.
Okay.
He's also a little bit like Kid Gilchrist. You know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
Every game from him. He's going to be athletic. He's going to be physical. He's going to play hard on both ends. And, you know, you also know what you're not going to get. He's going to struggle a little bit with length. I think he thinks he's a little more skilled than he is. He's another guy that suffers a little bit from maybe wanting to do things that he shouldn't be doing, as opposed to the things that he should be doing. I mean, you see that. I can't tell you how many gyms I go into where the big man is wanting to show me that he can shoot threes. And, you know, the little guys want to show me that they can post up. It seems like no matter what you are, you want to be something you're not. And I especially think that's true with big guys because, you know, I had an ex-NBA player who's now an NBA exec tell me the other day, look, it's no fun being a big man. You know, you run down the court, you hope somebody gives you the ball. You're very limited in, you know, sort of what coaches and teams want to ask you to do. And every big man dreams of being able to handle the ball and bring it up and down the floor and shoot threes. That's what you want to do. That's the fun part of basketball. Not just running up and down the floor and posting up. That's not the fun. That's not the funnest part of the game. And the guys that succeed in the league are the guys that figure out that's where I make my living. That's what I do well. And the guys that struggle are the guys that still want to have the fun part of the game and want to do all the stuff that they wish they could do instead of what they can do. And
you know what,
I
Chad? Think, Chad, yeah. This is what I tell the guy who's producing today's podcast, Dave Jacoby, all the time. Dave Jacoby is a great low post player, and sometimes he decides it's more fun to run fast breaks and take three-pointers, and we yell at each other. So he's disagreeing now. But, yeah, it's not that fun sometimes to go down and bang bodies and take elbows at the back and get rebounds and do that. Can't you kind of totally see Thomas Robinson's point here? Can I just stay out there and shoot threes, please? Anybody? Yeah. But yeah.
If you watch him at Kansas, he'll do that occasionally. Want to bring the ball down the floor, or want to catch the ball at the high post and spin to the basket. And he's actually not bad at it at the college level. But when you get to the NBA level, it's a whole other thing. And so if Thomas Robinson will just work hard and be content doing his thing around the basket and, you know, hitting face-up jumpers when he's wide open or whatever, but not be obsessed with dribbling the ball and proving to NBA guys that he's got range on his jump shot and all that stuff, he'll be really, really good at the next level. And that superstar, probably not, but really, really good.
All right. Well, we didn't get to Harrison Barnes and Perry Jones. We'll get to them next time. We'll have you on as we get closer to this draft and we figure out the order and all that stuff. But the Anthony Davis Unibrow Sweepstakes, it's going to be tonight, since we're taping this Tuesday for a Wednesday, tonight on ESPN. Before the Celtics Heat game.
Are we going to play the lottery one last time? We did this last year.
I did it. I played before we came on, and Cleveland won.
Cleveland won.
Yeah. So okay. We'll see. We'll see if that holds. It held last year. Chad Ford, look forward to Mock Draft 5.0 as soon as you know who the teams are.
Take care, Bill.
All right. Thanks.
So I get to sign off. Whoa!
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.